गुरवे राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्णभक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। गुड आफ्टरनून, गुड इवनिंग टू ऑल ऑफ यू अगेन। थैंक्स फॉर कमिंग एंड थैंक यू टू विक्रम एंड सुमुखी फॉर रिसीविंग अस हियर योर ब्यूटीफुल पैलेस। Very happy to be here again. And as we were mentioning today in the morning, the idea is that during the evening gatherings, if it's okay with you, we can do what I like to call not so much Q&A, but Q&E, which is quest and exploration. I mean, I have nothing against questions and answers, but I prefer to engage in exploration in the sense of I may try to give an answer, but it's never from a conclusive point of view. This is my answer, topic closed, next topic. But most we are all in a quest, and the quest has many questions, or we may have questions and the questions set us on a quest. And it's a whole exploration in itself. So the nature of the topic is endless. We are trying to say something about the infinite, as ridiculous as that sounds, right? Okay, I'll say something about the infinite. Okay, you can say something, but it's the infinite, so you can just touch one point in an endless line. So we can again be explorers in this endless path and eternally continue to share and hear, share our hearts in deep connection and empathy. So that's it. If you have any questions or any topics you may like to continue exploring together, unpacking, not necessarily related to our presentation today in the morning, but also if there is any question related to the presentation in the morning, you can also bring them. Actually, I think Ramachandra has one of those.
I do not, yes, thank you.
Okay, so we can start there and then we see where we end.
Well, I very much appreciated everything you said this morning, Maharaj.
But?
My question is if this is the standard, if Trinada Peace and Ichinara is the standard for us to arrive at, as you said, like our regulative principles, so that we can actually chant the holy name, so the holy name will manifest within our kirtan, within our chanting. If we find in ourselves that we don't possess those qualities, then we may feel that we're excluded or we're not qualified to go any further.
So what to do?
So what to do, Matthew?
Yeah, so...
Sorry.
No, please.
Just, I don't have a number for you.
Yes, of course. Well, first of all, I'd like to clarify in case I was not clear enough, and I apologize in advance if whatever I shared today in the morning created the idea that only when you reach this third verse, you are actually doing something. Before that, sorry, but it's not counting at all. That's not the point. That's not my intention. As we were saying today, like this third verse is about nishta. But you can only reach nishta going through all the previous stages to nishta. You cannot just be in nishta. You cannot force yourself into that stage. So we will need to go through the previous stages. Many of them are very messy, as we were saying today, ups and downs. And that's how you get to nishta. And those ups and downs are also part of the journey. And they are glorious in themselves. So just clarifying that my intention was never to say, only when you perfectly embrace the third verse, you are actually chanting, and before that, it doesn't touch Krishna's heart. No, that's not the point. You can sit there at Mananda Prabhu's room. Yeah.
Higher than you.
No, yeah, come on, please.
Higher than the else.
Yeah, no, it's fine, please. Let's be practical.
Yeah. Because you might not be comfortable.
That's fine there. It's fine. Practical, your intention is taken, but practical considerations are also applied. So, And all of them are sitting above me also. So, so you are not alone, Jessica. It's a collective crime.
Yes. We can all make offenses together.
No offense, just in case. So, what we were saying today is like this verse, the third verse of Shikshastakam concludes, Sankirtaniya Sadahari. Right? So he's saying, if you want to glorify Krishna constantly, in an uninterruptedly, this verse is taking you there. But that doesn't mean, but before reaching the uninterrupted level, there's no kirtan, there's no praise, there's no service. That's not the idea, right? I'm reminded of Jiva Goswami. He comments in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu when he's describing sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, prema bhakti. So sadhana bhakti is bhakti in practice, and we are engaging our senses in service to Krishna. And by doing that properly, at one point we reach bhava bhakti, when we have emotional ecstasy for Krishna. And he's saying, in one sense, and he doesn't want to discourage anyone, but he says, in one sense, bhava bhakti is real bhakti. Like implying, when your heart is blossoming with ecstasy and love, that's bhakti proper. And he will say, he's not, again, do not get discouraged, he's not like neglecting every or discarding what happens before bhava bhakti. But he kind of describes that as the preliminary actions to bhava bhakti. Like he gives the example, if you're about to do a yajna, a fire sacrifice, and before the actual swaha, before the actual yajna, let's say you are in the forest or you're in India at that time, someone has to go to the forest and pick the wood. That's, technically speaking, that's not part of the yajna. That's a preliminary action, and then the yajna starts. But at the same time, without that preliminary action, there's no yajna. So in that sense, it's part of the yajna. It is and it is not, if you will. So Jiva Goswami will say the same way, bhava bhakti is the yajna, the fire of ecstasy coming. And whatever happens before that is like getting together the wood for the sacrifice, like putting things in place, putting ourselves in place. Which again, you could say it's not part of the yajna, but it's part at the same time. If those things are not in place, the other thing cannot take place, right? So in the same way, we can say, okay, ideal chanting of the name of Krishna is absorbed and uninterrupted and ecstatic. Okay, nice. But who is there? Who can press a button and be there? It doesn't work like that. So it's good to have that goal in mind, so we don't, how to say, we don't get complacent and think, I'm already chanting, so I'm already there. No need to grow, no need to improve. No, there is always some invitation forward. But also not to get, discouraged or neurotic about, I'm not practicing, I'm not there yet, what I'm doing has nothing to, that's not the case, right? So if we are listening, these classes on the third verse of Shikshastakam, we may feel, okay, I'm not there yet. Of course, my intention given this class is not to for you to feel unanimously, we are not there yet, Maharaj. So therefore we feel outside of the loop. That's not the idea. It's just to hopefully shed light in, if we are not there, okay, but let's have a clear picture of what's the next station, what's the next short-term goal. Even if we are not there, having some idea of how that looks like, it may help our journey. And if we are not there, there is place for a healthy, humble longing to be there. Or if I realize, okay, I'm not humble, I'm not tolerant, I'm not respectful, there's place for healthy repentance also. And that's what Mahaprabhu does in the previous verse. Right? Okay, the third verse speaks about humility. Trinadapisunichina, super humility. The second verse of Shikshastakam also speaks about humility. Another level of humility. When Mahaprabhu is lamenting, Durdaiva Nidrisham Mihajjanina Anurag. I'm so unfortunate that I don't have attraction for the name. That's a type of humility. It requires humility to put on one side of the scale all the virtues of the name, like Mahaprabhu is doing in that verse. No? all so many names that we say today, all the energies are in these names, no hard advanced rules, such is your mercy, Bhagavan. You have to be humble to say that. And then to contrast that with, but my heart is not melting in connection to that. That requires humility. So in itself, that sincere lamentation is taking you closer and closer to the next verse that has to come, right? It's paradoxical, right? Because, oh, I hear about that, I don't have it, I lament it, and I start to have it by lamenting because I don't have it. You follow my point? So that's how Mahaprabhu is leading the way, you know? In the second verse, he's representing the sadhaka, who has some shortcomings, and who is in a healthy way, acknowledging the shortcomings, not in depression, not over-identifying with my anartas and thinking, I'm lost case, I stopped practicing. No. But realizing that, okay, there's something getting in the way. And pray from that place to Krishna for more mercy, for more shelter. No? The mercy and the shelter is already there, but we need to enter into a humble space to open our heart for that, to feel the need for that. If we don't feel the need, you may be surrounded by all the mercy in the world, but if you are not in need of that, you are not seeing it. No? Like if you are not dying of thirst, you may be surrounded by bottles of water, but you don't see that. If you are dying of thirst, you see one drop of water falling there and you see it. Right, so yeah, there is hope. That's a conclusion, basically. No, so we are sharing the symptoms of this verse, which is the next stage for most of us to embrace, nishtha. But if we are not there, still we are chanting, still we are serving, still we are worshipping. And there is place for healthy lamentation. Srila Prabhupada will use this expression, lamenting for that which is not worthy of lamentation, which indirectly implies there is something that is worthy of lamentation. So we have to find what's the corresponding lamentation that is worthy and healthy for my stage. Again, not to become depressed and be crying and lamenting unnecessarily, but there is something that we can lament for, something that we lack that we would like to have, and lament in the context of prayer and begging for mercy. And that lamentation becomes something that attracts, you know, Krishna and his grace, and we move forward through that, right? So, what do you think, Ramachandra? But is it clear? What do you think? It makes sense? Something else that?
No, it makes good sense, Maharaj. Okay. So going through the initial stages of Shraddha, Sadhu Sangha, Vajina Kriya, the holy name plays a part, even though we're nothing's black or white.
Exactly. I mean, holy name, of course, is all powerful. So what we're emphasizing with this third verse is basically, let's try to live a coherent lifestyle that helps us to take advantage of that power from the name. It's not that the name becomes more powerful, or the name is all powerful, but it's like the sun. Krishna sometimes compared to the sun. So the sun comes, and sometimes it can be too much. We are all like, okay, pull the curtains, and here comes the sun, right? Like the sun said. But if I choose to hide myself in a cave, I don't see the sun. It's not that the sun is not there, it's just that you are looking somewhere else, right? So the sun of the name of Krishna is all powerful, always giving all mercy. But we have to live our life in a way that is not hiding in the cave, so to say, but living in a way that we open ourselves to that, to those rays, to that light, to that sun. And some detail regarding what you mentioned, Ramachandra, that I'd like to say also. Is that, and I think this is important, at least for me, but I think for all of us in the community, in all communities, there's place there just in case, if you need. Feel free to sit higher than the Swami. That's a concern for the ones who are just coming, we'll make it clear. So, yes, So something important, at least for me, is like, okay, we are not in Nishta, we are not in Bhava, maybe we are not here or there. And where we are now still may seem a little bit like messy, as we say today. At the same time, that messiness is in the context of bhakti, right? That, as we say today, all the symptoms of unstable bhakti, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur mentions them as, they are part of the journey. So that the messiness confirms that you are on the journey, in one sense. So there's reason to celebrate it, even. Not to remain there forever, but to also take that as, okay, this is a symptom of bhakti at the unstable chapter. But it's bhakti. So it's inside the blessed context of bhakti, right? So I'm messy in the context of bhakti. God bless this mess, as they say. You know, there's a saying, God bless this mess. A Hindi blesses. So I think that is very important for all of us, no matter which stage we're in, to enter into this mood of, I'm practicing bhakti by Krishna's grace, by the Vaishnava's grace, Guru's grace. The goal of bhakti, what's the goal of bhakti? Sometimes prem is called prem bhakti. So the goal of bhakti seems to be bhakti. In other words, if the goal of bhakti is bhakti, in one sense you already attain the goal. In one sense. We still need to reach more refined versions of it. But bhakti already came to your life. So it's a matter of time. If we are sincere, if we don't become a monster that opposes bhakti, which you don't seem to be the type of people, there's no reason to think that we won't continue progressing more and more. And that's the type of confidence that I think we need to have in our practice and that Krishna gives in the Gita when he says, I don't know, Name Bhakta Pranashati. No, he tells Arjuna, declare that my devotee never perishes. Nehabi Kramanashasti Pratyavayana Vidyate, second chapter. Those who make a slight advancement in this path, whatever they acquire is never lost. No. He gives this type of like, this boost of confidence. No, don't think that by having made some mistake, your human life is endangered in your next lifetime and you may be born as a frog in Argentina. Who wants that? With all respect with my native country. So, because sometimes I've seen devotees also getting a little bit too, they give more, they put more weight on their own anarthas than on Krishna's mercy. That may be too hot for you, Arjuna, there, no?
No, cool.
It's fine there? The sun there?
Okay. Like
okay. Because sometimes we have our shortcomings, we have our stuff, but sometimes we over dimension that and we forget the power of Krishna's grace. And if we will be able to put all our anarthas together in one bag here, no, and put it on one side on the scale, and on the other side of the scale you put Mahaprabhu's mercy, who wins in the scale? What do you think? My anarthas, they are so powerful that they will defeat God himself. Oh, stop that nonsense. Krishna's mercy is always more powerful. So we have to practice with that faith, with that trust, that I'm already doing bhakti, and if I'm sincere and open, no matter the messiness, the ups and downs, I'm already on my way to the success. In one sense, I'm already doing bhakti. In one sense, I don't need to go anywhere. I'm already doing what I want to do forever. Right? I want to do bhakti forever. I'm doing bhakti. I'm already doing what I want to do for eternity. So there's reason to celebrate. In one sense, you're already there. And just you need to continue refining that, which also happens forever. Right? If you tell me, but when I attain Golok Vrindavan, that's when I reach my goal. In one sense, you attain Golok Vrindavan and you continue to refine your bhakti there. It's not that you reach Golok Vrindavan and there's no further growth and progress and everything becomes stagnant there. That's not Golok Vrindavan, right? So in one sense, it's a perpetual unfolding of love and begins here and now. And that's from that place our acharyas will say a devotee doesn't care for liberation.
That's what Maharaj?
From that, understanding this, our acharya say a devotee does not care for liberation. Because in one sense, they're already beyond liberation. Of course, one thing is saying it, another thing is living. But Mahaprabhu, in the next verse, of course, he says in Sikshastakam, verse 4, Mamajan Manijan Manishvare Bhavatat Bhaktirai Tukitve. I don't care coming over and over again, taking birth here. It's okay, he says. As long as I can offer to you unmotivated bhakti. I don't care where I was born. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, if I'm born as an ant or as an insect, that's fine for me, he says. As long as it's in the house of the devotee, he says. But I don't want to be born as Brahma if I am devoid of bhakti. So the condition is bhakti. As long as bhakti is there, send me whatever you want. That's secondary. The primary consideration is I can love you, I can serve you. And again, we are already doing that. So I'm just saying that in connection to Ramachandra's question, like to there is place for us to feel blessed and fortunate, and I'm already doing what I want to do forever. I mean, hopefully you want to do this forever, because if you are not okay with doing bhakti forever, that may sound like a tortuous prospect. So we have to befriend the practice in a way that seems nice in eternity, that seems plausible and sustainable, right? So, yeah, I just want to add that footnote. Gandaki Prabhu, Nandaki Prabhu.
So, bhakti comes to us through the bhakta.
You are going to my first book now. I know where you're going.
No. What I'm trying to do is like, I personally try to avoid the bhakta, and then your bhakti doesn't develop. So it's like we are fully dependent on the bhakta for our bhakti to grow, and to put ourselves in the right association, in the right mood with the bhakta, it seems to be the major, it seems to be the all in all of the process. So that Trinada Pini mood is another mood of being humble. And how do we develop that kind of relationship with the bhaktas so they can pull us up? It doesn't happen naturally sometimes. The appreciation, to realize that we actually at the mercy of the bhakti, all through the journey. The challenging part is finding, putting ourselves in the right place with the right association. I don't know if you could say something like that.
Yeah.
This seems to be the crux of the whole process.
Yeah, well, of course, as you may imagine, sadhu sangha is very important. Scriptures say that it's the root cause of bhakti. Chaitanya Charitamrita say Krishna bhakti janma mool hai sadhu sangha. Krishna prem janma tenho punar mukhya anga. That's an interesting point. It says Krishna bhakti janma mool. Mool means root. Janma means birth. So the root that gives birth to Krishna bhakti hai sadhu sangha. So bhakti comes from the bhakta. But then it says, not only sadhu sangha is crucial to begin bhakti, it says Krishna prem janme tenho punar mukhya anga. Once you attain Krishna prem, punar mukhya anga. Mukhya anga means main limb. So sadhu sangha remains being a main limb when you attain divine love. Right? It's not like, okay, I have no bhakti or I'm just beginning, I need sadhu sangha, but now I'm getting close to Golok Vrindavan, so I don't need you guys anymore. I just go on my own. No, in one sense you could say the closer you get to the goal, the more important that becomes, right? Because in ultimately what's a devotee or a Vaishnava or a Bhakta is a personification of love. And our goal is love. Our goal is not Krishna. Our goal is love for Krishna. We don't want Krishna without love. I don't want Krishna just like a toy to entertain me or a puppet. He's a perfect object of love. So our goal is love for us and even for Krishna. I like to say that love is such a goal that in one sense is a goal for Krishna. I'm not saying that Krishna doesn't have love. I'm saying that he always strives for more love. That's the nature of love. Love is such a goal that you can always attain more. It's insatiable in nature. That's another point of the conversation, but love is not something that, okay, I have love, now I take rest. Okay, I'm full of love, I attain Golok Vrinda. The more love you have, the more you yearn for more of that. That's the nature. Mm-hmm. Like Chaitanya Charitamrita says, Krishna, the gopis' love is increasing at every moment. It doesn't stop. And that makes Krishna more beautiful at every moment. And the more beautiful Krishna becomes, the more the love in the gopis' heart increases. And the more that love increases, the more Krishna, more beautiful Krishna becomes, and so on and so forth. And then Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says, and the two of them enter into a competition in which none of them accept defeat. Mm-hmm. Krishna becomes more beautiful, gopis more loving, more beautiful, more loving, more no end to that. That's how the spiritual world unfolds. That's why it's not boring to be there, right? Because sometimes we hear what Krishna does during the day in Golok Vrindavan, and on some level it seems that generally he does similar things at the same time. So if the internal experience is not always growing, to go to a place for eternity when you do basically every day the same thing, it sounds like hell, not like heaven, right? We want some surprising, some new things. So that's happening. Now, of course, there are always new things happening externally, but the most important thing is their hearts are always transforming. So it's never the same. It's never the same Krishna. No. Rupa Goswami describes, and I'm going back to your question in a minute, it's connected. Rupa Goswami describes one development of love with the word anuraga. Anurag, sneha man pranaya rag, anurag, bhav mahabhav. So anurag, the symptom of anurag is that you perceive the object of your love as if you have never seen him before, though you have been with him probably 5 minutes ago. I have met with him multiple times. But the nature of love is that it's renewing your appreciation of the object of love, and it's renewing the personality of the object of your love. So for example, Sri Radha is with Krishna in the romantic union, and after being together for reasons of the Leela, they separate, and Sri Radha is with whatever, Lalita, Vishakha, and Krishna's on the distance, he has to leave. And Radha will look and say, oh, who is that blue sapphire boy that is walking? And Vishakha will say, that's Krishna, you have been with him 10 seconds ago. She'll say, no, that's not Krishna. That's not the same person. That's not the same guy. It must be someone else. And she's right in one sense. It's Krishna, but it's an upgraded version of Krishna. He became more beautiful. And her love for him became higher again, as we were saying. So it feels like we are always meeting for... They are always falling in love forever. Right? For those of you who have fallen in love, you know there is a period for that, and after that... reality knocks your door, basically. And you have to take a few other responsibilities. But in anurag means falling in love all the time, constantly, because it's always new. We cannot even imagine what's that. Don't try to think much, because some smoke will come. So I was saying all this to mean that love is of such nature that is a goal to attain perpetually for us, for Krishna, for everyone. That situates love as the real goal of life for everyone, including God. That means that's the goal of life. If it's a goal of life for God himself, that's the goal of life. So Chaitanya Charitamrita says that even when you attain goal of life, sadhu sangha is so crucial, because you continue developing your love, but you will have these personifications of love, let's say in the form of a Rupa Goswami, Rupa Manjari, these eternal associates that are the role models after which in our tradition we attempt to serve Krishna. So it's always important, if you are, I don't know, here an artist or a musician or who knows what, you tend to look for role models, right? After, in the beginning, you start emulating, you start even copying, imitating, mm-hmm. and eventually you develop your own style, your own individuality, your own identity. So this is kind of the same. So how to relate to the Vaishnavas according to the third verse of Shikshastaka? We will talk about that in the next class in the morning, but a few trailers of what we will see. Something that Rupa Goswami says that I like to mention, this connection. He speaks about Sadhu Sangha in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, or Nectar of Devotion. And he says Sadhu Sangha must have three ingredients. Because Sadhu Sangha also can be a loose term. Like a loose term, like a general idea, but what we don't necessarily relate to every devotee in the same way. And doesn't mean that's bad. It's just we cannot relate to everyone in the same way. But Rupa Goswami says Sadhu Sangha, a real transformative association, has to have these three qualities: Swajatiya, Swatavara, Snigdhasya. So what's the meaning of this? Snigdhasya means affectionate. There has to be affection in the interaction, in the association. It has to be intimate, loving, affectionate Sadhu Sangha. It has to have Swajatiya means like-minded. You have to feel that you are on the same page with that person, that you speak the same language, that you resonate with each other. It doesn't mean that if you don't resonate, there's something wrong with the other person or with you. Just different species of sadhus also. We honor and respect everyone, but also we will have our inner tribe, so to say, right? Like-minded spirits. No? I can feel, okay, we are on the same page. We talk the same language. So Swajatiya means that, like-minded, like-hearted, not only mind, heart. Snigdhasya, affectionate. And Swatavara, which can be translated as more advanced. So no doubt we need association with more advanced people. But also I will add to that, and we were talking about that today, I think during lunch or at some point, how when we get together in a circle of people that we create a safe space and we trust each other and we open our hearts, something higher comes through us. You follow? So it's higher than us, but it's coming through us. So for me, Swatavara can also mean that. Swatavara not only means associate with someone higher than you, of course, also that, but you can also associate with maybe peers that are very honest and sincere, and when they get together, open their hearts, through that opening, sincere opening, something higher comes, descends through them. That's possible also. So again, Sadhu Sangha needs to have all those ingredients. I will argue, if those ingredients are not there, I wouldn't call that Sadhu Sangha. Rupa Goswami said, this is what defines Sadhu Sangha. No? Affectionate, like-minded, and more advanced, or something more higher is coming through that gathering. If that's not happening, maybe we cannot call it Sadhu Sangha. Maybe calling it Asat Sangha, I don't know. Sometimes that can happen. Asat Sangha doesn't only mean don't associate with those who are not Vaishnavas. Asat Sangha means just getting together in a way that is not honoring Sat, honoring truth. So we can get together among Gaudiya Vaishnavas and do escapism together. Yeah. And that's a satsanga technically. Although externally we have all tilak and kanti and everything is legal in the temple. But we are gossiping, we are criticizing, we are getting together to not to confront what needs to be confronted in us, but to escape together from what needs to be seen. That's not satsanga. I wouldn't call it satsanga. That's a satsanga. Sometimes the Asat Sangha begins at home. No, it's not so much, be careful with the Maya bodies, be careful with the atheists, all of them are Asat Sangha. Probably I am Asat Sangha. If I'm not honest enough, I may represent Asat Sangha. So yeah, I will say that, no? Like first, when we speak how to relate to the devotees according to the third verse of Shikshastaka, first we need to find that people with whom to. Because the third verse of Shikshastaka, again, it speaks about lots of honesty, openness, vulnerability, revealing the mind, hope. So you won't do just with anyone and everyone. No? There has to be some selectiveness. Not because we are better than anyone, just because. So we need to be respectful with everyone. We need to be tolerant and humble in different ways with everyone, including everyone. I don't even like the expression non-devotees, just in case. Non-Gaudiya Vaishnavas. We need to apply that but that will take different forms, right? Because if someone comes here and tries to attack you physically, okay, you have to be humble with everyone. I won't just like bow in front of the attacker and just let him do whatever he... Here, I may jump on the person and start beating him. And that will be a form of humility, though it doesn't look like but humility ultimately, as we'll see these days, has to do with committing myself to the truth and bowing to the truth. So in this case, the truth, someone is attacking a Vaishnava, I will have to protect them. So, but if we are talking about Vaishnavas that we trust, that we love, that we see, okay, this is my sadhu sangha, this is my tribe, like-minded, affectionate, something higher is coming, of course, we are invited to to open ourselves as much as you can in that circle. No? That's what's required from us. That's our part. Again, as you were saying, sadhu sangha is so important, but we have to do our part. Mm-hmm. I can be surrounded by the highest sadhu sangha on earth. I can have the topmost Mahabhagavat guru on the planet. But what I'm doing with that myself, if I'm not doing my part, I'm not really taking advantage of that association also. No? So it's so crucial to have proper association, but it's equally crucial to do my part, if you want to call it to be good association myself also. It's not just where is good association, how much you are striving to be good association also. It's always reciprocal. And it's not only where is my guru, where am I as a disciple? Where are the sadhus? They are there, but are you ready to open yourself to that company? That's an important question we need to make. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, and also I think that, as you said before, we can become this one that we are not here ourselves. And I feel that sometimes we are carried along by association.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like when we lack all sorts of things, but if we have the right mentality, we seem to be carried along, even sometimes, and we are lifted up. So I think
That's how I like
good fortune that we can.
That's how I like to think, to interpret some of these verses, like sadhu sangha sarva shastra kai lava matra sadhu sangha sarva siddhi hoy. Like by just one lava means like in Bengali, like a nanosecond. Like one nanosecond of sadhu sangha sarva siddhi hoy, all perfection comes. And on a literal reading, that may sound like an exaggeration. Like, just 1 second, all perfection, where that's going on. I'm not saying that happening. 1 second and you're there. So how to interpret that verse? Of course, in principle, that's possible. If you really are fully open to the best association, everything can happen in a moment. That's not generally the case. We don't have that capacity of just... fully receptive, but even I will interpret that verse even if we don't have that full capacity, if we come in touch with Sadhu Sangha, we may receive in one moment something that will change our life trajectory forever. And in that sense, all perfection has already came. Then it's a matter of time that the whole thing unfolds completely, but all perfection came in that precise moment in the form of association and so on. So if we are on some level open to that, that seed starts to sprout, no? To grow gradually, gradually. In some cases, if we water that more, it will grow quickly. If we water a little less, if we don't do the weeding process, we know all these analogies that Mahaprabhu gives. Some cases may take more time than others, but again, the process is working. Again, unless we become extreme offenders and the whole thing is uprooted, which again, I don't see that going on. But if not, the process is going on. No, already. It's happening. So we should celebrate that. For some, it may take a little more time, less time. But again, the whole process should be joyous. No? Once someone asked Srila Siddhar Maharaj, like, Guru Maharaj, how many lifetimes will it take for me to attain the ultimate goal of divine love? Srila Siddhar Maharaj was even like confused by the question. Like, nobody had asked that question to him before. So like, and his answer was like, the devotee was kind of with the calculator at hand. No? Like, how many lifetimes? No? If I start practicing bhakti in this lifetime, how many lifetimes will it take or whatever? And Srila Siddhar Maharaj just say, but if the process itself is so nice, what's the rush? That was kind of his natural answer. No? You are supposed to be enjoying your practice of bhakti. That was kind of the implication. If that's not the case, then how you are practicing bhakti? If your practice of bhakti is something that you want to get rid of as soon as possible, or it's just a means to obtain liberation, that's not what we are supposed to be doing. But bhakti properly practiced, Krishna says in Gita, shushukam kartum, should be practiced with joy. Of course, there will be obstacles and suffering. I'm not trying to paint an la-la-la picture, right? We already talked today in the morning about suffering and messiness. But even in that context, the process of bhakti remains beautiful and glorious. So his answer was like, what's the rush? If bhakti is beautiful, enjoy the journey, so to say. It's not about when I get rid of this and leave this place as soon as possible. That's a mukti-oriented practice. And mukti is not our goal. So, yeah. Thank you. It's windy. Some other question, Colin?
Can you say something, just a simple question really, but the understanding that Krishna put Arjuna into Mahamaya to obviously speak the Bhagavad Gita, but also, from what I understand, he utilized one of his energies in a way that was appropriate to give him a certain realization.
What do you say with the second part? I'm sure if I got the second part. He utilized some of his energy?
He utilized the material energy, basically, to give him an appropriate realization. So can we understand in our own journey in bhakti that when we might be going through a bit of a roller coaster in life, that the Lord's utilizing his various energies in differing ways to almost like a homeopathic principle of trying to bring out, you know, a cure from a negative kind of a poison or something like that.
Yeah, it makes sense. I appreciate the homeopathic analogy. It's the analogy that sometimes I give is more, it's connected somehow. It's a GPS. I don't know how much a GPS is connected to homeopathy, but in the sense of GPS, you are driving and the GPS tells you, okay, turn right now, and you turn left. Happens. So you do a mistake. And the GPS, what does the GPS say? recalculating, right? So the GPS starts to think about the best possible scenario considering your latest mistake. Right. So you go in the wrong direction, but the GPS immediately provides you with the ideal arrangement considering where you are now and how your mistake took you there. Okay, you made a mistake, took you there, but from that mistake that took you there, still you can learn something and get to proper destination. And then we turn back again, wrong place. Again, GPS is recalculating. Always. It's not like I'm tired of you. Get lost forever. Right? It's recalculating. Like constant adaptation and constant arrangement to provide us with the best possible scenario to learn the lesson we need, which is another way of what you are saying. Krishna, his energies, trying to accommodate things. Of course, we are not seeing that, but that's who he is, being an ocean of mercy. He's really concerned on a personal level with each one of us and trying to contribute, to make his part. Of course, we have our free will also. It's not that he can do everything and we just do nothing. That's not reciprocal. So as long as he can do his part while honoring our will, he's trying to extend his grace and mercy as much as he can. No? That's how we like to sometimes interpret this famous painting by Michelangelo that you can see. I had the fortune last year of being in the Vatican, and we went to the museum. It was very interesting. Interesting things. Not everything very interesting, but some very interesting thing. And the last part, it was like 3 hour walking through a different place. And the last part was the 16 chapel. And on the rooftop is this painting where God is kind of like extending as much as he can with all the angels behind him. And on the other side, it's the human, no, which is like again, there are many interpretations to that painting. I did my research, but one of those is the one that I intuitively came with. It's like how much God, Krishna, is extending himself as much as he can with all his associates and energies and grace to redeem us, to make the best arrangement, but also sometimes how we are a little bit like in our comfort zone, like, okay, I don't know, let's see, I will think about it. Okay, you are offering that, Krishna. I'll check. I'll think about it. And he still keeps waiting, right? He's in our heart. He never left a note like, I'm fed up with you. No, get another Paramatma. Right? So that's again how we can practice tolerance, right? Mahaprabhu is saying, be tolerant as a tree. Well, Krishna's being as that much tolerant in our heart, witnessing who knows lifetimes of things we are telling to him, or we are even denying he's existing, and he's there, okay, waiting, trying to recalculating. He turned wrong, recalculating. Someday he will get it, right? Yeah, that's this beautiful section in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. When, as you may recall, the main character of one part of the book is Gopa Kumar. And before being Gopa Kumar, his name was Sarup. he became Sarup. So anyhow, the journey is that when he reaches Golok Vrindavan, Krishna is telling Gopa Kumar, lifetime after lifetime I saw you denying my existence and not caring for me, and I was caring so much for you and trying to take your attention in one way or another, but you were so expert at avoiding me, basically. But I try to make this, and eventually now you're coming. And Krishna starts to like thank Gopa Kumar for coming. No? Because the humility of Krishna was like, I want to be with you so badly for so long, and you are finally fulfilling my desire of being with me. No? Even though Krishna was the main one trying to make all the arrangements for him to come, eventually hitch. But Krishna at the end is always like, thank you for fulfilling my wish. No? So that's the God we worship, let's put it that way. It's not an indifferent guy far away above the clouds and we are just here left to our own sense of orientation. But it's someone, the closest of the closest who is, who is favorably trying to make the best possible arrangement at every step. So yeah, that's another way of saying what you are mentioning, no? Because remember, even if we talk about Maya Shakti or Mahamaya, and I know that sometimes this happens in the lingo of the devotees, like Mahamaya or Maya Shakti is depicted as like a bad lady in this case, like Satan in the Gaudiya Vaishnavism or something. But that's not actually the case. Maya Shakti is an energy of Krishna, and she's serving Krishna. She's in service of Krishna. She's not against Krishna. And therefore, she's not against anyone. She's a Vaishnavi. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that. So my point is, all these energies are not against us. No. We sometimes, in our will, choose to be against Krishna and against ourselves and against our best interest. And Maya Shakti has some service to perform to facilitate our choices. But it's not that she's like celebrating, okay, now this guy is falling in illusion, another one in my trap, let's organize a party to celebrate that he's farther and farther from Krishna. That's not Maya Shakti. That's why in the scripture says she's sometimes like embarrassed of the service she has to perform. Because it's not that she likes that. She would like to see everyone serving Bhagavan as she is serving Bhagavan. You follow? So I think it's important to get that right so we can see, okay, all these energies of God, they are not conspiring against me. We are not confronting the world is not against us, in one sense, so to say, of course. There's people who may try to be against us, but the world in terms of Krishna, the material energy, and so on, there's no conspiracy, basically, in that direction. We have to choose. We have to do our part also, right?
I don't know. But Srila Sridharaswami famously said that the environment is friendly, right?
That's a famous line he does invoke very often. The environment is friendly.
The environment is
friendly.
Friendly.
No. And if we are perceiving basically enemies, it's our own mind. There's not outside. No? It's not outside. Even if you say, no, Maharaj, it is outside. Look at that guy who is insulting me, or at the end of the day, that guy is not against you. Even if he thinks he's against you, it's his own unresolved stuff projecting that onto you. But at the root level, nobody is enemy of anyone. That's a layer of illusion. No, the soul cannot be an enemy of the soul. With the filter of false ego and all that stuff, we think we hate that person and that's bad and this is good and I'm attacking you. But when we raise our vision a little bit more, we realize that's not possible, actually. So I have no real reason to take anything personal. If someone insults me or attacks me, it's generally, it's not against me as a soul, as a jiva. It's something else that needs to be solved and healed and somehow. So in that sense, Srila Sarasvati said, the environment is friendly. And the only enemy is our own. Krishna says that in the Gita in his own way. In chapter 6, verse 6, he says, the mind, uncontrolled mind, worst enemy. But then he says, well, when the mind is controlled, it's your best friend. So, that's it. The worst enemy is inside of you, but that worst enemy can become your best friend. And your mind becomes your best friend, there are no more enemies. That's what Jesus will say, love your enemies. In the sense that, how can you love your enemy by realizing that there are no enemies? Except your own mind, who is not loving. But when your mind becomes loving, becomes your best friend, there are no enemies. The environment is friendly. We do not see that way, but at least it's good to know it in principle as a principle to orient my life. Because if not, I can see enemies everywhere. Everyone is against me, everywhere is a conspiracy, I am the victim, and probably I'm not doing the inner work I need to do to make my mind my best friend. Sometimes we overemphasize that our mind is our enemy. and we forget to see the mind as a potential friend. So by saying the mind is this, the mind is that, I'm reinforcing the pattern that the mind is my worst enemy, and I'm making it even worse enemy every time I say that. Instead of, how can I befriend my mind? How can I start? It's a challenge, no doubt, because imagine if I told you, okay, you have a worst enemy. Try to think about your worst enemy. Hopefully you don't even have one. But let's say you have one. And then I say, on top of that, the mind is even worse than that. And on top of that, that even worse enemy, the challenge is it has to become your best friend. That, wow, that's a journey. But that's a beautiful journey, a beautiful challenge, right? Because of course, and I don't want to go too far from the point, but when we say the mind is best friend, worst enemy, in one sense the mind is not someone else there in my head or anywhere. It's not a person. The mind is just subtle matter, psychic matter. So it's responding according to how I'm feeding it. If I'm feeding my mind with junk food, it will react accordingly. If I'm feeding my stomach, no, there's not a person in here called stomach, but there is an organ called stomach. So if I'm just feeding my stomach with junk food, the stomach will, you will even say, my stomach is killing me. Right? Oh, it's killing me. But the stomach is not killing you. You are killing your stomach by putting all that junk food there. And the stomach is just reacting, saying, hey, you are killing me. Right? And you may call that, oh, my stomach is my worst enemy. But actually, you are your worst enemy of your stomach by putting all the junk food there. So in the same time, in the same way, the mind is kind of the stomach of your subtle body. It's like a stomach. It's like an organ. If you are feeding your mind with junk food, you will feel my mind is killing me, driving me crazy. But you are, it's not that the mind is your enemy at that moment. You are the enemy of your mind by putting all the junk stuff there. When you start to befriend your mind, it reacts accordingly, right? What do you think? Is that clear? Does it make sense? Arguments, refutations, everything is welcome. No problem. If you brought some rotten tomatoes for the summit there, I can welcome them here.
Marjorie, I was just thinking this morning when you were saying about, you know, if you isolate yourself and you're suffering sorrow, and it seems that, you know, when you're talking about the nature of the mind being so strong, the mind, how it's not, you know, very friendly at times, that, yeah, it's just, it is a very big obstacle to overcome in spiritual life, doesn't it? Because the mind is so related to the ego, the false ego, being separate from Krishna. And so therefore, it's like if you get on the mental platform, you naturally isolate yourself, and you naturally, if you isolate yourself, you're not the nobody, you're a somebody, you're the only body in that type of existence.
Yeah.
So it seems that, I mean, obviously we understand from the Gita, you know, Krishna, you know, admits it's very hard to overcome, but by constant practice and detachment. But I guess then it comes back to what Manjaki was saying, what we were saying before about, you know, the mercy of the bhakti, it's just really interesting, the whole, how it all lines up.
Yeah, and of course sadhu sangha, this connection is also keeping connection with people that somehow is reminding us of this type of things, because sometimes we are not expert to be sadhu sangha for ourselves. And to remind ourselves of what's actually going on about the mind, dualism, all this stuff. Sometimes we need someone else to tell that to us. No? All of us, we need constant reminders. So also sadhu sangha is that company where we take care of each other by reminding what's actually going on, and not the stories that sometimes we run in our minds that are like a distorted movie of actual reality. No? So many times happens that we just are listening from somewhere or reading and like, oh yeah, of course, that's what's going on. And I heard it so many times and I forgot that so many times. So, and again, not to chastise ourselves, but just to, okay, I'm back on track, let's move forward again. And in time, with proper practice and realization and taste and maturity, yeah, we won't need to go to those places that often, so to say. We'll be more present, more focused.
Yeah, Guru Jan Prabhu has this famous kind of vital phrase. He says that if you... Guru Jan Prabhu.
Yes.
He says, if you take shelter of your mind, you must live separately from Krishna.
Mm. Mm.
That's
very
powerful.
Mm-hmm.
You take shelter of your
mind,
you must. You use the word must, so you must.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
there's no option.
Yeah, there's no option.
Mm. No option. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's basically what the Bhagavatam also says. Bhayam dutiya vinivesha dasyat. We're talking today. The separatism, separateness, like dualism. The mind creates like, as we were saying today in the morning, first verse of the Bhagavad Gita is that. It's Dhritarashtra saying, what did the Pandavas and my people do on the battle of Kurukshetra? So he clearly sees them, us, and them. So that's the whole problem. A dualistic mind, like fragmented consciousness. Instead of seeing connection, unity, is parts, not wholes. But the scriptures say reality is whole, complete. Om Purnam Adha Purnam Idam Purnat Purnam Udachyate Purnasya Purnam Mahadaya Purnam Eva Vasi. Purnam is whole. No? So the world is whole, Krishna is whole, whatever is connected to the whole is whole. It's complete in itself, but we don't see that. We see just fragments, parts, broken bits. That is how the mind filters reality.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting because you see in children that are traumatized, children that a lot of the devotees here work with children, and children that aren't from a wholesome upbringing, they have problems that are unnecessary. They're kind of just unnecessary problems. They're like for a normal child. So that it's kind of quite interesting, because then if you think of ourselves in connection with Krishna, when we separate ourselves from Krishna, we also have problems that don't even have to be there actually.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and from that trauma.
Yeah.
And yeah, you really see that with children. You know, it's just they're traumatized from an upbringing that hasn't given them shelter and unconditional love.
And of course, in those cases, many times we grow into adults that still carry those wounds if they are not resolved in time, right? So you can be 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, and still the brokenness is there and needs to be addressed also as part of the journey, as part of Anarthani Vritti Vajana Kriya's healing. Yeah. Bhadra, you had some question?
Following on from Chakram's question. In the second chapter of Gita, when Arjuna was going through his lamentation, and Krishna says things to him like, your enemies will describe you in unkind words, they'll think you're a coward, what could be more painful for you, etc. He seems to be appealing to Arjuna's kind of lower self.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what that means, what's the lesson in that for us?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, as we were saying before, and also connected to Trivikram's question, Arjuna's so-called illusion, it's basically ours, no? Because Arjuna is a Nitya Siddha Parikar, he's an eternal associate of Bhagavan, so there's no way he can fall into illusion, so he's put into, let's call it mystical illusion. So I will make the case more in connection to Yoga Maya than Mahamaya. And for our sake, so we can relate to his journey of lamentation and desperation and so on. So Krishna, of course, throughout the Gita, again, Krishna is talking to Arjuna, but remember, he's talking to us, and we are in different stages also, no? In this, like Arjuna in the Gita, at one point he's lamenting, he's like, I'm about to go crazy, I'm dying, I won't fight. At one point, okay, he's ready to fight. So he's in different places. It's not like he's always in the same place. So basically, Krishna is kind of trying to accompany the different places Arjuna is. Of course, this represents a lot the guru-disciple relationship also, right? Krishna represents the guru, Arjuna, disciple. And the disciple can be in different parts of the journey, at different moments, different days. And the guru is also willing to adapt. Now, it's not the guru says, okay, this is the only answer, always, forever. No, depending where you are, I will say this in this way. Depending where you are today, I may need to, or depending each person, I will say the same thing differently. So we were saying today, Sveswe Adhikari Janishta Saguna Parikirta. You have to ascertain your adhikar, like where you are, what's your capacities today to do this, to not do that, and accordingly act, or accordingly the guru instructs. So we will. I will say that those verses that you refer to, which does do not seem to be like the, how to say, the most confidential level of instruction in bhakti, let's put it that way. Or as you say, no, Krishna is not appealing to Arjuna's higher self. We'll be more in connection to that moment in which probably the guru, let's say in this way, or the guide or Krishna himself sees, okay, you are not ready for higher instruction, basically. If I tell you something deeper than this, it will, we will go, because you are too much concerned with something on some level. Okay, so let's address that level you are concerned with. Because Arjuna was bringing these arguments in connection to reputation and some other things in connection to a more relative level, which there's place for that. Again, there's people in that level, and we cannot force them transcend, be higher than that. That's where I am. So Krishna is trying to create some. That's not his final instruction, no. So he's trying to pinch a little bit, no? Arjuna's ego, and to show also how he's building a whole case in that section, trying to also show Arjuna, take Arjuna to conclude, like what you are doing is nonsense, basically. All these arguments you are bringing, like when Arjuna says, I will become a mendicant. And Krishna's like, come on, you're not a mendicant. No, you're a kshatriya. Even if you run away from the battlefield, your nature as a kshatriya will bring you back by force. When you hear the conch shell of the first day of battle, your blood will like, and you will be there. So you will be drawn by force to the battlefield. So better you act not drawn by force, but voluntarily choosing to be there, instead of trying to escape. That's spiritual bypassing, right? So all these different things, no? that Krishna is trying to make Arjuna understand, your arguments do not make sense. No? If you are killed in battle, you go to heaven. No? That's the destiny for glorious kshatriyas. If you win the battle, you enjoy heaven on earth. So basically Krishna is trying to make that point. Doesn't matter. You go to the battle. Or then when Arjuna says, when Krishna starts to speak about the nature of the soul, he starts to say the same. Like, oh, if you are killed, not killed, at the end of the day, you are eternal. So why you are lamenting? No, basically, that's the point of Krishna over and over again. Why you are lamenting for that which is not worthy of lamentation? So yeah, in that particular section, he's appealing to what he sees that are Arjuna's sensibilities at that moment. No. He knows he's a kshatriya. And for a kshatriya to become, how is it in English? Infamous? That's worse than hell. Not for other people necessarily. That's more specific for a kshatriya.
Dishonor is worse than death.
Yeah. But for some people, that's not the case, I will say. But for kshatriyas, ooh, that's the case. I mean, for other people, maybe also, but not for, that's not, some commentators say that's not a universal application. For some people, dishonor, they're fine with that. They move on. But for a kshatriya, So Krishna's appealing to Arjuna's kshatriya-hood, kshatriya-nature, trying to activate that, because in one sense, in that section, Arjuna is kind of evading that. I mean, he is a kshatriya, but he's trying to be, again, a mendicant, escape the battlefield, and Krishna's trying to trigger his kshatriya nature, so he enters into his dharma, basically, no? Into his varna. You have a nature, and that section of the Gita is a lot about that, right? Like, don't escape your nature, don't escape your duty. Better do your duty imperfectly than someone else's duty perfectly, and all this type of emphasis. So I think it's an important point to show how also a teacher should be ready to adjust and instruct the disciple accordingly. And sometimes the guru maybe have to say something that is not the highest thing, but it's as much as the disciple is willing or capable of taking, right? So you cannot just demand more than that, because that's a form of violence, basically, right? What do you think? But does it make sense?
Doesn't show empathy to Arjuna in those statements, but by your answer, he is showing empathy to Arjuna.
Yeah, so yeah, he's showing empathy at every moment. But it's good that, as you say, in those moments where we feel it seems he's not being empathic, how to understand those sections to actually realize he is being empathic. He's considering who Arjuna is, what he's going through, and trying to take him to the best possible, again, the GPS, to the best possible situation for him, right? That's the whole Bhagavad Gita, basically. Krishna trying to bring Arjuna to the best possible place. And at the end, as we say, very beautifully, Krishna tells Arjuna, okay, I've told you this, now you decide how you want to act. He's not imposing himself on Arjuna. I value your freedom. You're an independent, as Prabhupada say, I want all of you to be independent, thoughtful people. So Krishna makes that point at the end of the Gita. You decide, Arjuna, I trust you. And of course he decides properly, right? So,
You finished? I'm glad that the point about empathy came up. Because the perfect guru or coach or counselor, psychotherapist, the most effective way is to be in the other person's world, be empathic with them.
Yeah.
My question, this morning you talked a little bit about nishta, steadiness, as opposed to the up and down. And we all aspire for that nishta. And I'd like to say, if you can, because for me, anartha nivritti leads to nishta. And that for me, that's, and for maybe most if not all of us, that's dealing with the bad habits or the addictions or the deviations or the avoidance of Krishna. Would you say something more about the anartha nivritti in connection with nishta?
Okay. Yes, thank you. Of course, first of all, clarifying that I was talking about unstable bhakti and then nishta, it's a gradual transition from one to the other, no? Right? I like sometimes to give the example of when you see these waves and the beginning is like, sometimes we start like that in our practice. Today I want to become a pure devotee in 20 seconds, and the next day I'm like, I think I'm giving up. And next day again, like, and no, so it's a little extremely embarrassing, the contrast, but gradually it's the up and down, it starts to become more like this, and at one point it's okay, nishta, stable. So just to make the point, it's not like this and suddenly it's like this, but the undulation starts to become less prominent, we start to contradict each ourselves less and less, and gradually we attain that natural stability and maturity gradually, organically, right? And as you ask, anartha nivritti, because in this sequence of stages that sometimes we hear, strada sadhu sangha bhajana kriya anartha nivritti nista ruchya shakti bhava prem, we do not continue saying anartha nivritti after nishta, but it doesn't mean that there's no anartha nivritti. Actually, anartha nivritti goes all the way up to bhava, says Rupa Goswami. Now in prem there is no anartha, there is no chance of being. But even in bhava there may be some, maybe, he says, some slight stuff to clean, some possibility of apparat.
Who are you quoting?
Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. But we will say that when you are in nishta, the big majority of our anarthas have been cleanse, let's say. And that's why you can attain stability, because what keeps you unstable are the presence of these different anarthas, right? So, but that doesn't mean there are no anarthas, right? So still there are some anarthas. Before going there, one thing that I think is also important, for me, anartha nibriti is not only, how to say, anartha nibriti doesn't mean I just chant or practice and the anarthas go away, like magically. I mean, of course, things, purification happens without me being conscious of that. But for me, anartha nibriti is more practicing with a sincere awareness of which are the anarthas that I need to deal with, no? Like with some introspection, not just, I just chant and do not think about anarthas and they just like shoo, disappear. No, you have to to go through them and to be introspective and to try to cultivate some awareness of them. So that on one side, and regarding the anarthas in Nishta, I like to be specific. For that, I need to go to Madhurya Kadambini. So give me permission for a moment. Let's see where we are. Nishta. Oh. Where is Nishta? Okay, Nishta. Okay. I like to briefly mention which are the anarthas that Bhishmanath Chakravarti Thakur mentions in Nishta. Which doesn't mean that it's only this. He's giving like a broad definition. So he will describe five anarthas. First one is laya. Laya means like, how do you say this in English? 1 minute. Like drowsiness. Drowsiness. So still that's there. It's familiar for us. Don't think you will get beyond that easy. It will accompany you for some section of the journey. No? So he says still during the practice or during some of the engagements in bhakti, due to the presence of tamaguna, let's put it that way, still there may be some drowsiness, and somehow that may get in the way of our fully relishing devotional mellows and still not fully relishing the name, the pastimes. No? So Nishta means, let's understand, Nishta means you are committed to a practice, you are determined, and you practice externally without ups and downs, but it doesn't mean that internally you are like absolutely relishing everything, but you have this internal commitment and determination, and you continue. And eternally, of course, there is more peace, more balance, more sattva. But still there are elements, no? Like this. Mm-hmm. Or bhikshepa. He used the word bhikshepa. Second, which is distraction. No? While nishta means, in one sense, attention, determination, doesn't mean that there's no distraction whatsoever. We have always to be accustomed to not thinking in black and white terms. No? And when we say nishta, there are many stages of nishta also. When we say ruchi, bhava, it's not just one thing. There are so many expressions. Like when we say kanishta, madhyam, uttam, there are so many subdivisions of all that. Right? Then he mentions apratipati, which means lack of motivation. So that still happens in nishta. Of course, not in the same degree that before nishta, but still you may be nishta, on some level of nishta, and still there may be some lack of motivation sometimes. Mm-hmm. You may be engaging in the practice, but there is no like real interest and investment in them. Although you know, this is good for me, I will try to do it, but still there's no like enthusiasm in the mind sometimes too. Okay, let's chant japa now. It's like, okay, I know I have to do it. And I know why I'm not enthusiastic about this. I know what's going on, but yeah, I'm there. So you do it, but still work in progress. Let's put it that way. There's another one which is interesting. It's called kashaya. And that sometimes that's translated as repressed emotions. So even in nishta, that can be happening. Because again, we repress so many things on so many levels. So previous to nishta, we may be, okay, aware of have this repressed stuff, which is really gross. I need to work on this. But there are more subtle forms of repression. Mm? So many times we become aware of the grossest forms of certain anarthas, and those are purified, but that doesn't mean they are gone completely. Now they are just in a more subtle version. And in Nishtha, all that needs to be dealt with more like surgery eye, so to say, right? This is more connected to Rajaguna, says Viswanath Chakravarti Thakur. Even being in Nishtha, there is this potential danger of becoming proud of being in Nishtha. No. On some level, of course, at that also in Nishtha, you have some realization that ideally you won't fall prey of that, but you are not absolutely beyond that either. So one has to be careful. And then he mentions one more, which is Rasa Aspada, which translates as relishing the taste. But in this case, it doesn't refer to relishing the taste of bhakti, but relishing still having taste for something else separate from bhakti and having some tendency to relish some form of material pleasure separate from Krishna, so to say. So again, for me, and even it's interesting because then he goes from Nishtha to Ruchi. Ruchi means taste. And he will say, just to give you an example, there are two levels of Ruchi. He will say there are many, but he divides this in two. He said there is one level of ruchi in which the devotee will feel very deep taste only if the altar is very nicely decorated. He will look at the altar and feel ruchi, or if the kirtan is performed with very nice melodies and tunes and they play very nice, okay, that kind of evokes that. But if that's not there, they are not able to experience that. And of course, you say the highest level of ruchi is not depending on that. Kirtan will be out of tune, broken mridanga. Altar will be very simple, but ruchi will come nonetheless. So he even makes that type of differences, which for us may be, wow, that sounds quite superficial that you need a fanciful kirtaniya in order to feel something. But that happens sometimes, no? Even in ruchi. So to normalize a little bit these things. That's what I appreciate from Viswanath Chakravarti Thakur. Like in all these lofty stages of Nishtha Ruchi, still he's putting some embarrassing stuff there. Some type of messiness that even happens there. No? So we can also kind of normalize that. Okay, that's part of the journey. Still in those high stages, there are things to still work on. So... and from there, go back to where we are and work on our stuff. Yeah. So yeah, Anartha Nibriti continues. No? Depuration, purification continues. Nishtha, Ruchi, Asakti, even Bhava on some level. Madhurya Kadambini of Viswanath Chakravarti Thakur is a book that he describes all this in detail. Yeah.
What does it mean to specifically work on those things?
Sorry, again?
What does it mean to specifically work on those things? Obviously, we can understand you've got to work on some anatta that we're aware of, but ultimately, is it up to Krishna? We just pray to Krishna? Or, you know,
what will you say if someone asks you that same question? I'm asking you because I know you have the answer. So.
I don't know if I do have the answer.
Let's see. I know you have. I mean, in one sense, you already included the answer in the question also, yeah. We turn to Krishna, of course. We pray, we open ourselves. Yeah,
I mean, I guess what I'm coming through, certain artists might be there due to previous traumas that are unresolved, and that may take quite an explorative approach to actually understand what the root of that is, what the root of that psychology is, to know how to actually approach that. And actually that brings me to another sort of related question, was where does that verse Tattanukampam sit sit with that, because ultimately we understand whatever we're going through is a product of our own misdoing.
Mm-hmm.
So how much do we just tolerate, as that verse
uh-huh.
seems to indicate, and how much do we try and kind of etch out the actual roots of the psychology?
Mm-hmm.
How what's the actual understanding of it?
Mm. Okay. So Sri Krampur was asking about this famous verse from the Bhagavatam, Tatenu Kampam Shushamikshamano Bunjana Padma Kritam Vipakam Kritpad Bapurbi Bidanan Namaste Jivitasa Mukti Pade Sadhava, from the prayers of Brahma, where he's saying, Brahma is saying to Krishna, those who earnestly look for your mercy, they will tolerate whatever comes to their life in terms of suffering, understanding this is the result of my previous activities. And while tolerating, they will engage their heart, words, mind in your praise, in your service. And such a person is a rightful, how to say, heir to liberation. Although a way to understand that, and that's another conversation, is your lotus feet, divine love, actually, the ultimate liberation. So yeah, that verse speaks of tolerance, but it speaks of a different type of tolerance, right? In the Bhagavad Gita, we have one level of tolerance. Krishna says, "Matras parsas tu kauntiya shitoshna sukha dukha daha paino agama paino nityastam stitiksha shrabharata." You have to tolerate suffering, happiness. That in itself is an interesting idea, right? Tolerate happiness. It's like, well. because it comes and goes. He's talking about material happiness, material suffering. He's not talking about the joy of bhakti. And it comes and goes like the different seasons, right? Winter, summer. No need to be overtly happy because of summer and then depressed because winter is coming. Because summer will be coming again, but some winter will be coming. So learn to tolerate that. But in this verse of the Bhagavatam you are referring, Brahma is saying, not only tolerate the result of your past actions, but while tolerating, you engage in praising Krishna with all your functions. So it's another level of tolerance there. So, so that's an important point I will say in the verse. And in connection to the question, yes, of course, whatever comes, it's the result of our past actions. We accept that, but I don't read that verse like, you just sing the name of Krishna and tolerate the stuff that comes and don't think much about it. Also, I'm not saying overthink about it, because in one sense, there's no end to how much you can think anything. So be careful with thinking. Thinking can be also a big form of spiritual bypassing. Like once Richard Roll told me, like one of the biggest mechanisms against transformation, inner transformation, is thinking. Of course, he's not referring there to being deeply introspective and that, but just getting stuck in your head and playing the loop and just getting there. So I will say the verse is saying, with your heart, words, functions, you praise Krishna. But for me, that praise Krishna or offer pranam to Krishna, vidadan namaste, also entails being honest and sincere and praying and being introspective. It's not just praising Krishna in a very like mechanical way and I don't need to think anything, just Hare Krishna, go to Hare Bol. But it's as we were talking these days, what's the spirit to cultivate during the chanting? Introspection and this and that. So for me, this verse of the Bhagavatam invites us to, okay, something is coming. I know it's from my past activities, but what else do I have to learn from that? From where that's coming? What if that keeps coming? No? Because many times some things keep coming over and over again, and it's like, okay, why this is coming over and over again? There's something I'm missing here. I have to learn something from here. And you have to pay some special attention. That may take, as you say, take us on an exploration. No? So what's this? And in some cases, and I'm talking in general, each case is unique, but some cases people need to do therapy, to go to a professional healer of some way, to resort to some modality of healing to complement their practice. It's like if you have a problem in your arm, you go to the doctor. It's not like, why you go to the doctor? You don't have enough faith in the holy name. No, I have faith, but my arm is bleeding. I need to go to a professional. In other cases, okay, my psyche is bleeding. I need to go to the doctor. Doesn't mean I don't have faith in the holy name. But I'm just, it's a compliment. Right? It's all in the service. So in some cases, that may be required. Right? I've seen enough cases to conclude that in some cases, that's really required. And I'm saying that because I know that for some years in some circles of devotees, like doing therapy or something was like, that's like Maya, that's, we don't need that. Just double the number of rounds you are chanting. Just do more of what you are already doing. And many times you do more and you feel more miserable. So we may need to find other ways to still deal with that. And still you have to tolerate stuff, right? Because you try to heal or to solve some things, and still there is something that is unresolved, and you cannot become depressed or get angry or crazy. Just learn to coexist with that, and don't lose sight that so much mercy and love and grace is coming at the same time. No, so it's not that I only have to tolerate stuff. No, you are receiving so many gifts. And in that context, you have to tolerate something also. But what you have to tolerate is not to downplay that, but it's not everything. It's, in one sense, it's nothing in comparison to the grace that is coming continuously. It's not to downplay your duty of tolerating anything, but... yeah. As we say before, tolerance... tolerance is not just, okay, I have to tolerate. But to have to also understand why to tolerate something. When you have a reason to tolerate, you can do it from a more deeper place. If you don't know why to tolerate, and you ask me why to tolerate, Maharaj, just don't ask questions and tolerate. You won't tolerate much. It will be torture. And so we need to understand why. That's why the Bhagavatam say, you understand that this is coming from my previous actions. So you are understanding, you are establishing a causal relationship of this that is coming. I'm understanding I'm responsible for this. So I can tolerate with that understanding, with that responsibility. And in that context, praise Krishna and open to his grace. Understand that not only, as we say before, it's not only me tolerating, it's not my suffering that I have to tolerate. All of us are going through the same thing in our own way. So it's all of us. It's a journey all together. It's not just me going through this. That makes the problem bigger, isolating the whole thing. And I have to tolerate something, but as we say, Krishna's tolerating so much more in connection to us. And tolerating lovingly. No? So that helps to also do that ourselves from a loving place. Okay, we're almost 2 hours, so I think we can take a break, and tomorrow we'll meet again in the evening. So if you have some other questions, I will ask you if we can keep it in pause till tomorrow evening, and we continue addressing any questions you have. So tomorrow we don't have morning meeting, but we have the evening meeting here again. So thank you for your questions, your presence, your attention. See you tomorrow. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Om, Jai Bancha Kalpataru Vishta, Jupasat Sindhu Bhyay, Vachapati Tanam Pavani Pyo Vaishnavi Pyo Namo.